Hello, I'm Charles Mallett, and this is a UK Column interview. Today I'm joined by Chris Coverdale, who is a behavioural scientist and a peace campaigner. He's been imprisoned three times for sticking to the principle of observing the law as it's written. Chris, a very warm welcome to UK Column. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much, Charles.
Not at all. Now, there's going to be a huge amount to get through, and some of the audience will be aware of you and of your terrific work over the years. What I'd like to do, for the benefit of those that both know you and don't is just to go back a little bit to the time where, in effect, you were campaigning on the basis of the pursuit of peace, but the element of tax resistance had not yet been introduced. How, as a peace campaigner in that state, would you hope to achieve the desired effect?
Good point. All right. It really started for me in 2002, when the Afghanistan war was on by about 6-7 months. And I started to get very concerned about the legality of what was going on. So I was investigating fraud and corruption in the Foreign Commonwealth Office and discovered, to my horror, that we had been deceived. The whole British public and everybody had been deceived for 70 years or so over the illegality of war. It was quite illegal. And our leaders, Tony Blair at the time and Lord Goldsmith, were saying the upcoming war with Iraq would be legal and the war with Afghanistan was legal. And I was appalled by this and so started to see what actions we could take to get our government to uphold and enforce the law. So we started an injunction against the High Court against the government to try and prevent the upcoming war with Iraq. It didn't work, so unfortunately we lost and the war went ahead in March 2003. So that was my introduction to trying to stop the government breaking international law. Now, then later, as part of that, I started to really to look at the criminal offences that had been introduced into Britain in 2001 in the International Criminal Court Act 2001. Now, this was it had started off as an international statute, and the world had agreed in Rome in 1998 to set up the Law Enforcement Authority in The Hague to prosecute leaders who took us to war and committed the worst crimes known to mankind, mainly war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. So it was starting to look at that in detail. I realized that the criminal offense our leaders were committing was not actually genocide, but conduct ancillary to genocide. And I started to look at that in detail and realized after a while that aiding and abetting genocide was the crime that I was committing by paying tax. It struck me then, and I'm still totally committed to the issue, that if you pay tax to a government which uses the money for a criminal purpose, you are complicit in the crime. You are aiding and abetting the crime. And that's when I first started to realize that I must withhold taxes on the ground that it is a criminal offense to hand them over, knowing some of it be used to murder men, women, and children in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now in Gaza and the Yemen and the Ukraine.
That's an excellent sort of summary of how you've got to into some of the areas that you're now fully immersed. What I'd like to do, though, is just to go back, because obviously a lot of what we're talking about concerns law and treaty, but you referred to the injunction in 2002. In your eyes, if the process had been conducted properly, might be the right word to use, how would it have turned out? On what basis was your challenge made?
Well, basically, it's on the laws of war. The UN Charter, the main laws governing relationships between states are international statutes agreed mainly in the UN Charter. And it's very important, in a sense, to understand that when we signed and ratified the UN Charter, we agreed quite clearly with the rest of the world and all the people of the world through their governments never to threaten or to use force and to settle all disputes peacefully. Now, those are the two primary agreements in the UN Charter, which is the law underpinning the activities of the United Nations. And nobody in Britain seemed to be upholding it and enforcing it. So it became clear to me that we needed to not only educate our MPs and others, but everybody in the country. And one of the best ways of doing that was by taking it to court and asking the judges to define the law. What does it mean? You know, to me, to my mind, never threaten or use force and settle all disputes peacefully is a very clear statement that we have been breaking for 60 years or whatever it was at that time.
And by what mechanism did the High Court dismiss your...
Well, it's through a judicial review. We started and tried to get an injunction, myself and three colleagues, tried to get an injunction forcing or compelling Tony Blair and the cabinet to not start a war with Iraq. And but unfortunately, the judges, they always find a way around this. And they said, well, it won't be a genocide. It cannot possibly be genocide. And our other argument at the time was that we were likely to get attacked in Britain. And the judge said, no, that is most unlikely. It will not happen. And therefore, I dismiss this application. So, I mean, I didn't know much about the processes of law at the time. We were just doing our best to try to get somebody to uphold and enforce the law as we saw it. And in particular, the law under the International Criminal Court Act 2001, which had been introduced just 2 years before, and which introduced six crimes into English law. And those crimes were important to remember. They were war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide, and conduct ancillary to war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide. And those six crimes are the most important criminal offences the world has ever agreed. And it was quite clear to me that we were not only not upholding them, we were violating them and breaking them and committing the worst offences known to mankind. And that not only was our government, but our taxpayers and tax collectors were doing the same. So we tried to persuade the court to do this. I then tried to get a judicial review of the Attorney General's advice to Parliament and to the government because it was totally wrong and completely ignored the laws of war that we were signed up to as a nation. So a number of things there that started the ball rolling for me and I realized that I just needed to take action, personal action, to stop paying, contributing money to, it's only a small amount, but obviously every small amount that we pay to the government, we give our tacit consent to how the money is being used by the government, and we have to stop that. So that's how it happened. But of course, the courts themselves, I have to say, the courts in this country are so corrupt. They don't abide by the law.
No, indeed. And I think that's been made abundantly clear over the course of this year in particular. I mean, it seems to be a problem that's worsening and worsening.
Yes.
Just to clarify, because of course, what you've talked about is the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq and things effectively following the Rome Statute of 1998. just in the wider context, let's say going back to the Second World War and the interventions that the United Kingdom has been involved in, is there a case that may be made at all for any of the overseas engagements that the United Kingdom has been involved in since the Second World War, to your mind?
There is one example. As I understand it, certainly Declassified UK reckon that there's been 83 military conflicts up until last year after the Second World War. Britain has initiated and taken part in 83 military conflicts. That's a horrendous number of wars, mini wars, or small wars, but they are wars. And the only one, as far as I can find out, that may have been partly lawful was the Falklands War, when we were attacked by Argentina. And Article 51 of the UN Charter does allow a nation to use armed force on the sole occasion if it is attacked by another state, and by the use of armed force, the armed forces of another state. So that would be the only occasion that it may have been partly lawful. However, the way Mrs. Thatcher approached it, and the sinking of the Belgrano outside of the 200-mile exclusion zone was a horrendous war crime. So there was only partly lawful in what we did with during the Falklands War.
Absolutely. Now, you know, we've given some background now, and you've talked about the way in which you became aware of your belief that you were breaking the law in sponsoring such activities. Will you just provide a bit more detail as to the legislative background to that position?
Yes, indeed. It is important to understand the legislation. And in this particular case, I started to read through the whole of the International Criminal Court Act 2001. And by the way, there are two legal systems in Britain. The legal system that applies to England and Wales is separate from the legal system that applies in Scotland. And so we had two Acts of Parliament. One was the International Criminal Court Act 2001 for England and Wales and Northern Ireland. And the second one was the International Criminal Court Scotland Act 2001. Now, both of those really say the same thing, but it's slightly different wording in the Scottish thing from the England and Wales legislation. And the important sections in the England and Wales legislation are sections 51 and 52. Now, just before I go into detail on those, the purpose of the Act was not only to set up for the first time in history an international law enforcement authority in The Hague, but also to agree the criminal offences for which that court in The Hague would have jurisdiction. And I'm sorry to say that for the first time in 1600 years, our government signed up to an external legal lawful jurisdiction and so gave away jurisdiction over those crimes to every member, every resident of Britain, including the Queen and the Prime Minister and everybody else. For the first time since we had the Romans around, we are subject to an outside legal jurisdiction. So it is important to keep that in mind. That was signed and agreed in 2001, but nobody in Britain seems to know that, which is extraordinary, really. However, the crimes included, as I've mentioned, were six, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, and aiding and abetting those crimes. And those crimes are laid out in the international statute in Article 25(3) of the international Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, and they are translated into and ratified by the British government in Articles 50 and 51. Sorry, 50, 51, and 52. The main ones are 51 of the International Criminal Court Act and 52. Section 51 says it's a crime to commit genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And Section 52 says it's a crime to engage in conduct ancillary to genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And those are the two most important laws this country has ever signed up to. And when you look at the detail, ancillary offence is laid out in the legislation. And it is aiding and abetting the crime in the same way that we have in the Accessories and Abettors Act in 1861. We've always had this aiding and abetting crimes is a crime itself, and that is repeated in Article 52 of the International Criminal Court Act.
Absolutely. I think a point to note, and I should say at this point, there's a lot of technical detail coming out, all of which will be referenced in the notes attached to this interview. So don't worry if you've got your notepad and pen at the ready. This will be provided later. But I think something worth saying, first of all, on the, you know, who is a signatory to this and who has ratified the Rome Statutes, notable in light of current circumstances that the United States have not ratified it, Israel has not ratified it. And also, and I'd like your comment on this, the ICC itself has only achieved 10 convictions in the past 20-something years. So I suppose the question is, to what degree do you think that its establishment was sincere?
I think in the eyes of the world, its establishment was sincere, and they have been working for it for nearly 60 years. It took nearly 60 years to get a law enforcement authority set up. So most of the nations of the world and most of the signatories to the Rome Statute were very keen to have it around and still are. And it's only one or two who are operating behind the scenes to ensure it doesn't work effectively. And Britain and America and Israel are primary examples of that. So it is our leaders who are making sure that the International Criminal Court only convicts people in Africa and maybe others, you know, one or two. But unfortunately, although the law applies to all of us, we haven't yet to get one of our leaders into court at the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
And I think this could be a difficult one to knock into a condensed answer, but what factors do you attribute that to in terms of external influences?
Oh, gosh, I mean, it's very difficult. The more I have investigated what goes on in the British government, the more I realise that we are all manipulated all the time by forces behind the scenes, and that includes our justice system. I have been investigating fraud and corruption and corrupt practice in the justice system ever since I was first turned down in 2003. And everywhere I look, I find it quite incredible that our judges and lawyers and prosecutors and everyone involved with the justice system are just not following the law, but following instructions from somewhere, and I don't quite know where, to rake in the money regardless of the criminal offences that are being committed, and to ignore the crimes. It is horrendous. I even discovered it in the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary that it's openly out in the open, corrupt practice in the Supreme Court. In the case of Regina versus Gul, Mohammed Gul was imprisoned for posting a video on the internet taken by the Taliban of a successful attack on British soldiers. for which he was given 5 years prison sentence. But the case went right up to the Supreme Court, and it was all about the definition of terrorism. What do we mean by the definition of terrorism? And so the Supreme Court had it. Now, in most Supreme Court cases where it is questioning the meaning of the law, they will go through the definition of the law in the statute, in this case, the International the Terrorism Act 2000. And their definition, they sort of said, okay, in paragraph 4, I think it was, they said, well, what the definition is as follows. And it said section 1.1, section 1.2, section 1.4, and section 1.5. Now, I found that incredible. They left out section 1.3. And if they'd kept it in, they could not have made the argument that they were making to keep Mohammed Gul in prison and on the definition of terrorism. That is right out in the open, and nobody in the justice system pointed it out. I mean, it's incredible. So that's the sort of thing, and it happens at every level. And, you know, magistrates' court, county courts, the higher court, the Court of Appeal, and the Supreme Court. They're all in this together, and it's just unbelievable.
Unbelievable, I think, is exactly the right word. And we see it time and again, not just in this area, but the cherry-picking that is effectively conducted. And of course, now, yeah, with regard to what you've been speaking about, particularly the use of the UN Charter, and of course, with reference to, let's say, Israel at the moment, the use of the phrase self-defense, because of course, that is an enormous justification of untoward acts. What I'd like to do, you've talked about the Terrorism Act. Just to go on to continue the thread of having established that there is in effect no basis for war, and that the government and those that are supporting these activities are effectively in contravention of the International Criminal Courts Act 2001, sections 51 and 52. But going back to how that pertains to you or I, the individual, in terms of paying tax and the Terrorism Act, where does that get us to?
Right. It is important. Thank you, Charles, for raising that. In 1999, after again many, many years of attempting to get it agreed, there was an international convention agreed called the Convention for the Suppression of the Financing of Terrorism. Now, this is probably the second most important international convention or statute that we've got. It is now ratified by 188 nations. Ratification means bringing an international statute into domestic law. So domestic law of England and Wales or the domestic law of Scotland. Yes, we ratified that international convention with the Terrorism Act 2000 in this country, and that applies throughout Britain. And what it is it makes a criminal offence for one person to ask for money, to collect money, or to transfer money to another person or organisation if you suspect it may be used for the purposes of terrorism. And it defines terrorism as the use of firearms or explosives endangering life for a political or ideological cause. So that was the law brought into this country. And what I realized straight away was that any tax collector who was asking for money, demanding council tax or demanding income tax, whatever it was, inheritance tax, it was committing a criminal offense. And if they collected the money, that was a second criminal offence. And if I handed the money over, or if they, having collected it, handed it to the Revenue and Customs, then that was a third criminal offence. So it was not only a criminal offence for me to pay the tax, but a criminal offence for them to ask for it. And it was when I started to realise and go through the detail of that legislation, I realized how important it was that we use this legislation to ensure that our government uses all our money for lawful, legitimate purposes that never involve the use of firearms or explosives endangering life. Now, there was a very useful case, which I just referred to earlier, which was Mohammed Gul, Regina versus Gul, in which the Supreme Court said, looking at the definition of terrorism, this appears to apply to the military and quasi-military activities of the British government. Now, this is the Supreme Court saying, you know, basically, we are, the British government is committing acts of terrorism and funding terrorism when it gives orders to its military forces or the police to use armed force against anybody else.
I don't want to sort of derail where we were going with it, but that does bring a very interesting issue to the fore, which of course is the payment for and procurement of weaponry for the Ministry of Defence and everything that comes underneath it, and indeed the police forces of England, Wales, Scotland, well, I mean the whole of the United Kingdom. Is that something that has been challenged either by you or elsewhere?
I've tried to bring it to attention of the courts. I'm not very effective. I have, just going back over, once we started to realise what was going on was illegal back in 2003, we started reporting crimes to the police. We started with Lord Stevens and then Sir Ian Blair in the Metropolitan Police. And then we approached every police force in the country, all 44, I think there were at that time, saying, look, these are criminal offences, and would you please investigate members, local people who are breaking the law under these acts of Parliament, including the International Criminal Court Act and the Terrorism Act. And we reported these crimes more than 300 times, I suppose, in Parliament, in police stations, in by letters to chief constables and so on. And of those five attempts, of those 330 attempts, five of them got as far as the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Unit at Scotland Yard. Now, initially, I didn't know about that unit, but they are the police unit as part of the SO15, the terrorism outfit in Scotland Yard, who are responsible for investigating war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide under the International Criminal Court Act. So we did get material to them. And as a result of a lucky incident in Marylebone Police Station, two of my colleagues had gone in to report crimes, war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide. And the desk officer that in Marylebone was a Danish woman who was over here for a year on a transfer deal. She said, okay, and got on with it and passed it on to her inspector who had just come on duty. And he was an Irishman who was just about to retire from the Metropolitan Police, but was delighted to have the opportunity to pass this forward. So he put it to the War Crimes and Crimes Against Humanity Unit, which is the process that most police forces are supposed to operate when you report serious crimes of this nature. Anyway, that happened, and I was called into Belgravia Police Station, and I went there on five occasions for 3 hours and went through all the detailed evidence we had of our leaders, 25 of our leaders, committing these crimes in detail, and went through the law, the international UN Charter, the International Criminal Court Act, Geneva Conventions, and all the rest of it, and the Terrorism Act 2000. And eventually, the police officers in that unit were quite convinced. They understood this is what the law says, this is what is happening, it is quite obviously a criminal offence. And so they put it to the Crown Prosecution Service. And they had it for about a month, and the woman who was dealing with it, a senior prosecutor, was were moved to North Lancashire or somewhere like that, and or promoted. And they gave the job to one of the most junior people in the office, at Ludgate Hill. And 6 weeks later, we got a letter from them saying that the Crown Prosecution Service would not be going ahead with the prosecution of Tony Blair, Jack Straw, Jeff Hoon, Lord Goldsmith, and all the rest of them, on the grounds that we had not provided evidence of intent to commit war crimes, evidence of intent to commit crimes against humanity, or evidence of intent to commit genocide. Now, in fact, we had provided masses of evidence, and I'm happy to go through some examples of it in a minute or two, but we provided all this evidence to them, and they just ignored it completely. And the strange thing is that it's not up to the witnesses, to the ordinary public, to prove intent. That is for the Crown Prosecution Service to prove to a jury in court. You have to, they have to gather, the police gather the information that proves intent to commit genocide. So anyway, we've had a number of attempts at trying to get this in front of the police, the MPs and others and so on, but always unsuccessful. So we will keep trying, because the important thing about a crime of genocide is that there's no time restraint to it at all, restriction. And, you know, until the day Tony Blair passes on to another place, we can try and charge him in front of a jury of crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, along with all his colleagues. So we'll keep trying at that.